The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 121.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, a great buddy of mine that I've really been looking forward to speaking with. He needs no introduction. His name is Chris Irons, and he is the host of the QTR podcast, one of my favorites. Chris, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, buddy.
What's up, George? How are you?
I'm extremely well. So we did a podcast last week on your show, and you asked me some fantastic questions, but I was listening to it and I actually was pissed at myself because like the first three or four questions you asked me, I totally went off on a tangent and I didn't mean to. I just don't know where my head was at. So I want to circle back and ask you those questions so we can go back with some dialogue and really unpack that because I think they're very important. The first thing you asked me that I completely avoided answering was this, what's going on with the riots and the looting and this, I don't know if the Chaz zone is still there in Seattle or maybe they have more Chaz zones. I don't know, but I'd love to get your feedback on that. Maybe we can just kind of unpack it for the viewers or listeners.
Yeah, we're not going to miss it this time because on my podcast, when I have you on, I try to make a point to shut up and let you talk. But now that I'm on your show, I can just have diarrhea of the mouth for as long as I'd like, and that's what I'm prepared to do. So if your viewers are not ready for that, strap the fuck in because here it comes. Listen, with the social unrest, I mean, you talk about the Chaz, the autonomous zone in Seattle. Yeah. So if you don't know, they disbanded that. They wound up disbanding that section of the city about a day after the protesters showed up at the Seattle mayor's house. So in true liberal hypocrisy form, while the people were in the middle of Seattle turning the city into a, you know, shanty town and a cesspool, there was no love and no regard for the businesses in that section of town or the people that owned property in that section of town or the people that lived there and had to walk through that shit every day to try to get to their homes. The mayor had this very laissez-faire attitude, you know? It's the summer of love. It's peaceful protesting. We're not going to tell them to leave, even after they brought automatic weapons in and had walled off a part of the city. The mayor was just useless. And so if you were a business there, you were suffering greatly. There was property damage. There was people were impeded from making their way to your business. There were all kinds of problems. Lo and behold, nothing happens, of course, until these protesters show up outside the mayor's house.
Yeah.
At which point it then becomes clear to the mayor, hey, we've got to do something. Next day, that autonomous zone was disbanded. So the mayor there is a microcosm of many other liberal politicians and just Democrats in general and people on the far left in general who don't really understand that they just need a reality check. And often it's, you know, there's no calls for law and order until it's them that needs law and order. There's no calls for defunding the police when they need the police. So I thought it was good. Much needed wake up call for them. And that's what's happened there. As far as the social unrest in general, we were talking about, you know, my contention is that the social unrest that's occurred over the course of the last 2 months here in the nation has far less to do with George Floyd, even though that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, and far more to do with a lot of socioeconomic pressure and the inequality gap widening, which has been taking place excessively over the last 10 years, especially since 2008, even prior to 2008. And I think that the inequality gap being shoehorned open by reckless monetary policy from the Federal Reserve contributed in a huge way to the civil unrest that we saw that was supposedly due to systematic racism and the unfortunate death of George Floyd. Now, having looked back at the body cam footage that was released last week of the incident And having looked at the autopsy report, the one that was not funded by the Floyd family, and the coroner's report, and objectively, just my analysis, looking at the body cam footage, you had a guy that was clearly, per the autopsy report, on I think 11 milligrams of fentanyl, which is a fatal dose of fentanyl. According to the autopsy report, he died of cardiopulmonary problems and not from suffocation. That is in dispute by the family, so we'll say that. There was obviously no, it was obviously a horrible travesty that he died at all. That I don't want to underplay that, but from my reviewing of the body cam footage, start to finish of the incident, the officers responding to the place of business where he allegedly used fake money to the point where he was detained on the ground, there was nothing that indicates race was a motivating factor at all. In fact, I thought, and I'm not Mr. Yay Police either, okay? I've had my fair share of run-ins with police officers that have been less than pleasant. Sometimes my fault, sometimes the officer's fault. And in fact, my mother was hit by a police officer in a car who then lied about it and made it very difficult for my mother to have access to getting the insurance necessary to do the repairs. Wow. I'm not Mr. Advocating for Police, but I do advocate for truth and I advocate for common sense. And there was nothing in that video, but for getting in the officer's head, there was nothing in that video that said to me this had anything to do with race. They were more than willing to roll the window down for him if he was going to be put in the back of the police cruiser. He said, you know, he was claustrophobic, yet he had just gotten out of an SUV where he was sitting there with three or four other people. In the audio of that tape, you can hear the three or four people he's with advising the officer that he's on something. You can hear them advising George Floyd to stop resisting arrest. You can hear the police officers pleading with him to get into the back of the police cruiser for what seemed like several minutes, which when you're alleged to have committed a crime, that seems to be gratuitous. The answer should be get in the back of the fucking police cruiser and we'll figure it out when we go in front of a judge. But they pleaded with him and they were nice to him. So that may have been the straw that broke the camel's back, but there was nothing about that that said racism to me. I admit that there is racism in the country. I have seen it firsthand. I don't necessarily know if it is the systemic problem that people think it is. And I think that this underlying pressure people are feeling from inflation, people are feeling from central bank policies, likely contributed to the social unrest in the country and likely will continue to contribute to the social unrest in the country far more than what happened, the objective facts in the George Floyd case.
Yeah. You know where I get concerned with this, Chris, is if you're telling a group of individuals from a young age that there's no hope, that you don't have any hope because the cards are so stacked against you because of XYZ reason that may or may not be true. But at a certain point, and I'm no psychologist, but I don't see how it wouldn't become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, it does.
Right? And I mean, I look at my childhood as an example, which I obviously don't talk about much, but I was incredibly fortunate in the sense that I didn't have a perfect childhood by any stretch of the imagination. It was extremely turbulent and my parents got a divorce when I was young and whatnot. But one thing my father always did, no matter what I was doing, whether it was in athletics or some sort of competition or in school, it didn't matter how bad my grades were. And I almost flunked out of high school. It didn't matter how poorly I did at a sporting event, like for tryouts and ice hockey. You know, as a kid, I played ice hockey for 7 years. Or when I played golf or any of the sports I played, my father would always, when I came off the field or whatever I was doing, he would say, you know what? You're the best. You're the best person out there. You're the best one out there. And I'd be, well, you know, Dad, actually, I just got last place in that golf tournament. You know, I first started playing golf and I actually got good enough to get a scholarship. But anyway, he would say, well, you're the best one out there. I'm like, well, actually, that's quantifiable, Dad, because it's a score. And if your score is very last, then that means I was not the best one out there. But it didn't matter. He would always tell me that I was the best at anything that I did. You are the best. You're the best. From the time I was born to the time he passed away, and when I was maybe 33, 34 years old in 2005. So, but my point is, if you had the opposite of that, maybe not from your own parents, but from society at large, not necessarily telling you the worst, but telling you that no matter what you do, you're not going to be able to achieve a certain degree of success. Where my father was like, no matter what you do, you are going to achieve success just because that's who you are. So you see what I'm saying? And so I really get worried about the media and the kind of the narrative in the United States that could be doing more damage to the future generation of the poor middle class.
Of course, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because you're giving people an out that want it, and people that may not want it, people that are real hustlers by nature, that want to work, that want to be productive, that want to further their education, that want to develop their God-given talents. You start infringing upon their mindset, you know, of that work ethic,
exactly.
Right? Candace Owens talks about this all the time when she reaches this inflection point in her life where she said to herself, like, what am I going to do? Am I going to let the left tell me that I am a victim and that I've been a victim my whole life of this lopsided system that I can't control? Or am I going to get out there and hustle and honor the memory of my grandmother who went to bat for her and worked hard for her? And she said that was an inflection point for her. And, you know, I have several Black friends that I've talked to candidly about this. Interestingly enough, I'll tell you this. Race had never come up between me and several of my good Black friends that I see on the regular.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Never. For as long as we've known each other, there's never been a point where I sat down and say, hey, you know, George, you're Black, I'm white, let's talk about it. It just hasn't. We're too busy enjoying each other's company. We're too busy playing chess. We're too busy having a whiskey together. We're too busy talking about sports. We're too busy being friends, really, to give a shit about what each other's race was. Maybe they're thinking about it. I'm certainly not thinking about it. But both of them just said the same thing to me over the last 2 weeks, where, again, race was never an issue. It was never something we ever talked about. We talked about politics, maybe. They're both Democrats, but we never talked about race. And over the last 2 weeks, when I saw them, both of them, and I don't know if this is a coincidence or not, both of them brought up kind of proactively the issues of social unrest and how they felt about it and really how they wanted to distance themselves from it. And they came out and both told me that without me bringing it up, which to me is very telling. It tells me that there may be, you know, they may feel as though they're under pressure, that they're signing up for something here that they don't necessarily back. I don't want to speak for them, of course. And obviously I don't want to be that guy that's like, well, you know, my Black friend says, my Asian friend says, or yeah. I have a well-diversified friend group, because I really don't, you know, but I do happen to have a couple of Black friends, and this did happen over the course of like 2 weeks, and I couldn't help but notice it. And I think that is an unintended consequence of the media and specifically the left making this a big deal. It's like Kamala Harris's vice president, right? Would she have been picked for vice president based on her policy record and her record as the DA of California if she was a 60-year-old white man? The answer is no. You know it's no. I know it's no. The whole world knows that it's no, because Joe Biden wanted to virtue signal and came out and pigeonholed himself, because prior to selecting a candidate, he said, I'm going to pick the most qualified person? No, he didn't. He said, I need to pick a woman of color. It's like, all right, well, what if the most qualified person to be vice president of the United States is a Black man? What if it's a white man? What if it's an Asian man? What if it's a woman not of color? You know, why would you pigeonhole yourself on that just to go out and say, hey, look, I'm accepting of everybody? And maybe for him to cover for some of the blunders and the dumb shit that he said over the last couple of months You want to talk about somebody that's completely insensitive to his comments about race. Some of the stuff that comes out of that guy's mouth is frightening. So, but here he does it, right? He goes and picks Kamala Harris, and we've seen a couple of things since then. By the way, the same two people that I'm talking about both told me that they were going to vote Republican. Now, is two people a sample set that is indicative of anything? No. But did this as a coincidence just happen to me a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago and 2 weeks ago? Yes, it did. Why did they do that? The first guy told me he was sick of pandering. He brought up the incident where Hillary Clinton went on the Breakfast Club and told Charlemagne the God that she carried around hot sauce in her purse. And he told me he thought that was insulting. And he said he thought it was insulting when Kamala Harris did the same thing. She went on the same program and tried to act like, oh, she was all hood and she was smoking weed and she was listening to Snoop Dogg and all that shit. When really what she was doing is she was the DA of California putting people in jail and being a hard ass about it for smoking marijuana.
Yeah,
okay.
It's intellectually insulting to the people they're trying to pander to.
Exactly. I mean, and that's exactly what this dude said. You know, he said it's absolutely insulting to think that, you know, we would be so malleable as to just like, oh, okay. And the second guy said to me, he said, you know what, man? He said, I don't agree with Trump on everything. I don't like Trump. You know, he says some dumb shit. But he said, at least I know he's going to get out there and say what he's going to say. And then he said to me, quite frankly, I find them funny. I find them hilarious. You know, so take that for whatever you'd like. We also saw yesterday CNN poll numbers on Biden. The lead Biden had over Trump, and this is CNN, that margin had shrunk significantly. Whether or not that has something to do with him announcing his VP pick, I don't know. But Democrats don't seem to understand that they are really providing the wrong solution to a problem that may not be out there, and it could come back to bite them in the ass, which is what me and you were talking about. Actually, you were talking about. I was listening on my podcast. So
doesn't that
go ahead.
Show you the level of or the lack of ethics with politicians from the standpoint of, you know, I would assume that the presidency and the vice presidency, pretty important job.
Sure.
Not like you're hiring a telemarketer or an assistant, you know, where you're like, oh yeah, they'll do that. That's fine. Yeah. I like the color of their dress. Let's just hire them. Or I like that guy played high school football. Oh, great. So did I. Let's hire them. You know, it's not that you do that in the first place, but it's not just something that you take lightly. If it were someone like you or I who would be saying, okay, what can I do to benefit the country and society at large? But it's so apparent they're not doing that. And all they're doing is going around and trying to poll people to find out, okay, am I going to get more votes if I get Kamala Harris? Am I going to get more votes if I pick XYZ person, ABC person? And the scope of their analysis or thought process is just who's going to get me the most votes.
It's not just a lack of ethics. It's a lack of backbone, right? Peter Schiff said on his podcast yesterday, I don't want to be a fair weather capitalist. He was responding to Joe Kernan or somebody saying, hey, in the foxhole, we're all socialists. And Schiff said, no, I'm not a socialist. I'm not a fair weather capitalist. I'm a capitalist for the good. And I'm a capitalist during the bad times too, because it's his ideology that he believes in. And you could say the same thing about social issues. Do you want to be an advocate for truth? And do you want to be an advocate for what is just and what is best for our country,
which you can
definitely do without seeing race? You can do it. You can pick the most, you can commit to picking the most qualified candidate. You can commit to equality under the law for people. You can do all of these wonderful things without having race be an issue. You know, it's when you choose to see race first and then react based on that. Well, that's really the opposite of equality. That's a bias. That's, you know, favoritism. And, you know, I'm not discounting that there were some awful things that took place in the country's history. But I think that we are moving in the right direction. The country is doing a great job. We are far more cognizant of the repercussions of that and the terrible things that took place now than we have ever been. I think that we are making an honest effort to honor those, honor the terrible things that I don't mean honor them, but make light of them, to recognize them, to continue to bring them up. But we have to move forward also too. In the year 3000, are we going to be talking about what happened in 1950? I mean, right now in the year 2020, are we talking about what happened in, you know, the 1700s, the 1800s? We're talking about Columbus. We're talking about, you know, these were very, very different times, and times evolve. And I don't want to discount the bad that has happened. I don't want to say that those things didn't happen. I don't want to say that it's not important that we don't acknowledge them. But we have to press forward also too, and we can't let that debilitate us from doing what's best for people of all races, of all creeds, of all colors, of all sexualities, all of the citizens of our wonderful country. We have to do what's best for everybody, and we have to move forward together as a nation.
And I also think you have to be clear on what your objective is. So if your objective is to improve the lot of a group of people, maybe it's a particular race or the poor, the middle class, what have you, you have to say, okay, this is a defined goal. Now let me look back through history and see what has worked to improve their standard of living and what hasn't worked. And if you read the work of Thomas Sowell, he's done extensive work on this. And at no point in time has a group of people come up out of poverty into affluence through the help of the government, through a social program, through reparations. I mean, never, ever. In fact, there's almost an interesting inverse correlation between how well a group does and how little representation they have politically. So the Chinese would be a fantastic example of that, right? I mean, how many Chinese politicians do you see in any country? Yet every country the Chinese go into, they just kick ass at everything. As far as, you know, not athletics, but that's because it's maybe not their thing culturally, but in academics, in entrepreneurship, they're always, they don't even care what's going on politically. They just put their nose to the grindstone. They work 80 hours a week. They save 50% of their income, and they just go and they just dominate in their little way, you know, almost wherever they go. Now there's subgroups of Chinese that don't, but from that culture, wherever they are in Malaysia, in the United States, the Germans have been the same way, the Jews. And then what's interesting is the Irish, when they came to the United States, and this is all Thomas Sowell's work, not mine, they were heavily represented politically, but yet economically, they didn't do that well. When they were first here. So you see what I'm saying? So you've got to say, well, what actually helps? And I don't think right now anybody in the media or politically is actually saying, okay, what has helped in the past? And let's focus on that. They're just saying, oh, what makes people feel good right now? And I'll just go ahead and regurgitate that because it'll A, get me ratings, or B, get me votes. What do you think about that?
And I think a lot of it is right. I mean, again, you can be a good person and a person of character and a person that is well-developed and well-adjusted and tolerant of everybody. You can be that person and not have to put it on display all the time. You know, this is literally talking to you just now is the first time I've ever been like, well, you know, I have so-and-so friends, or I have an Asian friend, or... You know, you don't need to signal to the world that you're doing the right thing and you're being tolerant, because that's the norm. You should just do the right thing and just be tolerant. And luckily, you know, I was raised right. I wasn't raised in a household where there was bias or where, there was prejudice or anything like that. Maybe I would have turned out differently, but I was very lucky that I was raised very well. But I think that you make a very good point. I think that at some point you have to stop talking about it and just be about it. There was a YouTube video I watched a couple of weeks back of them going to houses that have those signs on the front lawn. You know, people that put those signs in front of their house. Hate has no home here. All are welcome, you know, and it's written in 10 different...
I didn't even know they were doing that. I've spent so little time in the United States.
Just drive through the suburbs in the United States anywhere, and you'll see them. People are ordering signs that say, hate has no home here.
That's my point.
We believe in science.
I think that's counterproductive. That's my point. It's just...
Well, it makes the person feel better, I guess, but there was a video where they were going around to these homes with, like, you know, it was set up, but they had what looked like a young Guatemalan guy who was, like, all kind of dressed in rags. And they would knock on the door, and person come to the door. They'd be like, hey, we noticed your sign out front here. My friend Gustavo here needs a home to stay in. Can you take him in? He's an immigrant. He's an undocumented immigrant. Can you take him in the home? And people are like, oh, you know, no. You know, like, we don't have room. We don't have space. You know, in every house they went to, everybody said the same thing, you know, which was like, no. So it's like, you know, you're just fucking full of shit. And that's really it. You know, it's if that happened at my door, I would be like, no, I can't. I don't have the space. I'm not prepared to be living with somebody. It's my choice. And the answer is no. But I don't have a sign out in front of my house that says all are welcome. I have a sign in front of my house, true story, that says concealed carry allowed on premises with a little warning thing. I'm trying to send a message to stay the fuck out of my house unless I invite you, right?
Right.
So it's just nonsense. It's just virtue signaling. It's the opposite of what we should be doing. Stop talking about it and be about it. Or as you say in sports, let your game do the talking, right?
Yeah, so this dovetails perfectly on something else I wanted to get your opinion on. I've been in the States in the last year, just maybe a few days in Fort Lauderdale when I was coming down to St. Bart's. And I noticed, I don't know if I was in a sports bar or whatever, but you know, you flip on ESPN and I can't even watch sports anymore. No sports. All it is people going out there and virtue signaling about what they think about Black Lives Matter, what they think about this political issue or that, or wearing masks or China or whatever. I'm like, how did sports?
And people say, George, what's the matter? You really have that big of a beef with the Black Lives Matter movement that's going to offend you? You know, let me just finish this thought real quick. If it was my podcast, I'd let you talk, but you know, forget about it. No, but people say, listen, is it that big of a deal to you to see this sign that says Black Lives Matter, whatever? And I give you two examples. One is I play FIFA, which is an Xbox game, right? A soccer game.
Soccer,
right? And the jerseys, on the backs of the jerseys on the FIFA game now all say Black Lives Matter. And when you log on to your video game, when you log on to play, you get a message, first and foremost, message from the FIFA team. At FIFA, we don't believe in racism. We think blah, 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 blah. Click OK to continue, right? So you have to click through that to get in. I'm like, do I need this? I'm trying to play a video game, right? I agree. I agree racism is bad. But I don't want politics. I want to sit on my couch stoned and play video games, right? The other thing, too, is I was on a dating app, right? I swiped through one thing on a dating app and it stopped me and said, we at Bumble, which is the name of the app, we at Bumble want to make sure that our ethics are the same with everybody else that uses our platform. We're not racist. We're tolerant. We're tolerant of trans people. We're tolerant of this, that, and the other. And there was only one thing at the bottom. I agree. And you couldn't click anything else. So if you wanted to use the app, you had to click I agree. And I said, you know what? I agree with all these things. But what I don't agree with is having to be indoctrinated to use this. Bang, you're fucking out. App deleted, problem solved. And just yesterday, I was at Whole Foods, and it's the same thing. You know, there's a little sign on the front of the building that says Whole Foods, about this big. And then there's a huge banner out front, Black Lives Matter, you know? And I'm just thinking, like, I just want to come in and get some food that is extremely expensive, okay? That's all I want to do. I want to come in, I want to pay $12 for a banana, and I want to leave. I don't need politics, okay? I have black people in my family, all right? My cousin is married to a black guy. They have a kid together. I love them dearly. I love them with all of my heart. I really do, okay? But it's not something that, like, when I'm going food shopping or I'm going to play a video game or, you know, I don't need to be reminded of that. I just, and when you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, there is a huge difference between being tolerant of people of different ethnicities and being tolerant of whatever, people of different sexual preferences, all those things. And by the way, I love everybody. All right. I'm a libertarian. I want everybody to be happy and do whatever they would like. But there's a big difference between that and supporting an organization really that has a very strong Marxist vein running through it. That makes me worried for people of all races, creeds, colors, religions, sexual orientations in the country, because I want what's best for the country and I want what's best for the world. And Marxism isn't it. And that's not a racial thing. That is just a ideological thing. I am not interested in the effects on turning the United States into a Marxist country.
Yeah. And I go back to just asking the question, let's just do a cost benefit analysis. Okay. So let's just say that every single video game has to start off by virtue signaling. Whole Foods, we have to have a sign there that says, we support XYZ, you know, everywhere you go. So I would ask first, how much does that actually move the needle? And does it move the needle in the right way? You see? So
it might appeal to other people that do the same thing. Like if you have a sign on your front lawn that says hate has no home here, and then you come to Whole Foods and you see that sign, you're like,
But I'm not talking about from a business standpoint. I'm talking about from a standpoint of extinguishing racism, right? So if you're a racist, right?
Doesn't do anything.
If you see all this stuff, is that going to be like, are you going to wake up one morning after you see that sign at Whole Foods and be like, you know what? This KKK deal, I've been wrong my whole life. Now that I've seen it on a video game, now that I've seen it every time I turn on ESPN and at Whole Foods, well, I gotta be wrong now. No, the only thing you're gonna do is make them even more stubborn and more grounded. That you get a lot more with sugar than you do with salt. And then you're saying, okay, well, let's say someone's on the fence, right? Is that really gonna tip them over the edge, or is it gonna do something like what you're talking about? And it's just gonna piss them off to where like, this is, I don't want anything to do with this. Let's get back to sports. Let's get back to Whole Foods.
Right.
I use the example of Formula One because I'm a big Formula One fan. And I can tell you that no matter how big of a Formula One fan, or you with UFC, you know, we're both UFC fans and you're into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and whatnot. If I saw Formula One on every time I went to Whole Foods, every time I turned on ESPN, every time I turned on a video game, it said, we love Formula One. I would be like, okay, I get it.
Right.
Enough. And it would get to the point where I'm like, you know what? I hate Formula One. I can't stand it anymore. Just get me away from this Formula One. So that's my point is that if we're truly trying to achieve a goal, we should be asking ourselves, what's the most efficient way to achieve these objectives? And I can almost promise you it's not through this virtue signaling that it is actually having a counterproductive effect on eradicating racism. It's just making it worse and it's making us even more.
Well, it's making race an issue where it normally wouldn't be an issue.
Right.
I think, you know, and I don't want to speak for anybody but myself. That's the most important thing. I'm just speaking for me. These are just my opinions. But the people I train with, the people I roll with, right, at the gym, guys that I spar with in jiu-jitsu, represent all races, colors, creeds, men, women, Asian, black, white, Indian. We have guys from, Thailand. We have guys from all over the place. Nobody in there is talking about race. No one. It is just not an issue. We're there to work out. We're there to spar. We're there to get in better shape. We're there to become better fighters. We're all collectively kind of sharing that vision together. And the people, you know, my training partner for the day when I go in is not, it's not determined by who's white, who's black, who's Asian, who's male, who's female, who's gay, who's straight. None of that. It's determined by, oh, who's my size and my skill level, maybe. But otherwise, you know, it's even good to get time in with people that aren't your size and aren't your skill level. It just doesn't come up. It's just not an issue. And for me personally, I mean, I feel like the majority of my day, it isn't an issue. Now, somebody that's of another race or somebody that's of another color or of another, you know, maybe another handicap or something like that may feel differently. So I don't want to speak on their behalf.
Right.
But what I think is we all want the same thing. We all want equality under the law. And we all want everybody to have access to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Unfettered access, you know, equality of opportunity under the law, whatever you want to call it. That's what we want.
I think you're hitting on a very important topic here. Let's just use your gym as a microcosm. You said that this is not an issue at all. It may be to some people, but if it is, you're completely not aware of it. It sounds like you've been going to this gym for a long, long time. So, and I'm assuming that your gym doesn't have a sign or a banner right in front saying, let's say Black Lives Matter. And when you sign up for the gym, you don't have to check a box saying that you're anti-trans, you're anti whatever that, you know, whatever's in vogue right now. So how on earth did your gym achieve that type of, equality, let's say, without all these signs, without having to check a box? I mean, how did that happen?
Right. Nothing. They have great instructors. They have a great program. They provide a great service. They have people that know what they're doing. They have a friendly environment and a friendly atmosphere. You know who my gym discriminates against?
Asshole.
They discriminate 100% right. The owner of my gym was telling me, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago or whatever, that the people he has turned away from signing up at the gym, he thinks are people that come in and they have an ego. People that come in and have an attitude, people that come in and they have, visible ties to gangs that he thinks may be trouble, may cause trouble for the people. But the owner of our gym, his name is Rich Latta. He's a fantastic human being. The owner of our gym is committed to making sure that the environment at the gym is a friendly, safe atmosphere where families can bring their kids, where people can come and train without being harassed. And Rich is a white man, right? But at no point has Rich ever discriminated against race or sexual preference or political preference or anything like that, because it's not even on his radar. You know, he's thinking about running a successful business. And what are the best decisions that I can make to run a successful business? So that's what he's concerning himself with.
But I think the key that you said, it's not on his radar. See, that's my overreaching point here, is that it's not on his radar. And everyone in the gym, it's not on their radar, because they're not thinking about this. They're thinking about going there to work out and getting better at jiu-jitsu. So would the gym be any better or worse if we had all these signs? My point is it would probably be worse, because now all of a sudden you're not thinking about jiu-jitsu. You're not thinking about what you should and what's unifying all of you guys, regardless of race or sexual preference or anything. Now you're hyper-focused on this thing that's just brainwashed into your psyche every single time you walk through the door of the gym.
And when we get together, when a group of 5 or 10 of us get together to watch fights, or at least when we used to before the quarantine, and there would be, you know, maybe 4 guys and 2 girls and some old people and some young people and some Asian people and some Indian people and some white people and some black people, and everything was a mix, mishmash of whoever, some Brazilian people, whatever. And we would get together and we would sit there and we would watch the fights, and we would watch Tyson Nam fight, you know, and or we would watch Khabib Nurmagomedov fight, or we would watch Conor McGregor fight, or DC fight Stipe Miocic. Nobody's saying, oh, Tyson Nam's from Hawaii. He's an Asian guy, you know, or DC's a black guy fighting a white guy. I'm going to bet on the black guy. I'm going to bet on the white guy. Nobody says that. I mean, just look at this last weekend as an example. Everybody was talking. Stipe Miocic versus DC. You know, who do you like? Why do you like him? Everybody was talking about it. Everybody talks about every fight. You know, people talk about Sean O'Malley. Nobody brings up, oh, hey, you know, he's got an Irish name. You know, like, no, nobody cares. People are only interested in the fight. They're interested in whether or not the guy can grapple well, or whether or not he's a striker, or what his record is, or whether he's got good wrestling, or whether he's got good footwork. You know, so maybe I'm being naive. I will concede that. Maybe I'm being naive because, you know, again, I'm just speaking on my behalf. I don't want to put thoughts in the minds of the people that I train with or the minds of other people out there and tell them what they're thinking and what affects them and what doesn't affect them, because I don't want to do that. That's not my game. I'm just telling you how I feel. What I can tell you is in the years that I've been training, I don't think I have ever heard anybody in my gym, and we're talking about 60 or 70 people that come through regularly and train 5, 6, 7 days a week. I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about race ever.
Yeah. All right. I mean, I could dive down that path. It's just so interesting. And I just wish we would have more of a conversation with actual psychologists. Like, let's talk to Jordan Peterson. Let's talk to Brett Weinstein. Let's talk to these guys to figure out what should be an appropriate measures that we can take that would actually move the needle and not just take us further back.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
I wanted your opinion on a few other topics here. First, sure. Did you see what's going on with this World Economic Forum?
No, I didn't.
With this Great Reset they're referring to? Okay.
Sounds like something we desperately need, though.
Well, so they have this World Economic Forum that's in Davos every year. So it's with all that started back in the 1970s with all these political heads. And now a lot of the hedge fund guys go there and, you know, the billionaires and whatnot. And it's headed up by this guy named Klaus, I'll send you a link to a video.
Of course.
He is straight out of a Bond movie. I mean, he is the quintessential Bond villain. He's Spectre. I promise you he's in charge of Spectre. But they have this push right now, Chris. It's for this Great Reset is what they're calling it. And because of the virus and what has happened, they're pushing for all these governments to institute all these draconian measures through their stimulus packages to increase pretty much everything that you and I are against. As far as they want to increase the scope of government. They want to increase the taxes. They want to increase the...
That's the opposite of a reset.
The regulations on everybody because they want to push towards a green future. And I'm not opposed to a green future, but I am when it's tops down. And sure. Because then it's not sustainable by definition. It's just going to cause inflation. We're going to be in a worse spot. But so if you haven't seen that specifically, what I'll do when we get done is I'll shoot you the link. And next time we talk, we can go over it. But more so from a centralized planning standpoint. I mean, I'm sure you're seeing it not only in the United States, but in the narrative with the IMF, with the World Bank, with this World Economic Forum. And I'm sure that concerns you, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on where this is going and what we might be able to expect from this and what their overall objectives are long-term. I mean, do you think there's malicious intent there, or do you think they're really, it really is about like a green movement, or you think they're just trying to gain power? What do you think?
Yes. Well, of course it's a power grab. Of course, anytime you want to expand the scope of government, it's a power grab. Of course there's malicious intent regard. I don't know if it's, you know, premeditated malicious intent, but that's where it's going to wind up. If the idea is to expand the scope of government, add to regulations, continue to run monetary policy globally, the way that we're doing it, it's going to lead to terrible consequences. They're going to further widen the inequality gap. They're going to further create social unrest. So if that's the case, we haven't seen anything yet. Because if we keep moving in that direction, we're going to have profound problems. And I think this is part of what Warren Buffett may be starting to realize. He came out and bought Barrick Gold last week. That was the story on Friday After Hours. And the reason I thought that he did that is I said in a podcast that I did in early May that, you know, Buffett is the best, but he's the best inside the Keynesian bubble that we've had. And once you step outside that bubble, which has to become an inevitability at some point, that the rules change. And I think his legging into Barrick Gold might be an indication that he's starting to see that. The problem, in other words, got too big even for Buffett. And I think this printing trillions of dollars over the course of the last 3 months, or the amount of stimulus we've done here in the last 3 months, is a wake-up call for some people that have lived, even though he was at the peak of the bubble, he was at the mountaintop in the Keynesian bubble. You know, he was the guy, the world's greatest investor. I think even he is starting to tap the glass on top of him and realize, oh, fuck, I am kind of in a dome here by myself, and that there's these other people like yourself and like Peter Schiff that are sitting outside that bubble just kind of watching all this stuff taking place. Like, well, there's going to be real hell to pay. I think as a result of the virus,
do you recall?
What's that?
How much did he buy? Do you recall?
$564 million worth of Barrick Gold, which is a nominal position for him. But A, it might not be the only gold miner that he's bought. He may have bought since then. That's only up to, I think, the end of Q2 for his 13F that he filed. So we don't really know. Or he may be out of it, too, conversely. But
as a gold investor, how do you see that? I mean, I would assume that you would consider that some tailwind to your thesis.
Well, in the words of UFC fighter Nate Diaz, after he beat Conor McGregor, I'm not surprised, motherfuckers. Like, I've been saying for a long time that, you know, George, people buy gold because they want to preserve their purchasing power. Right. And they buy gold miners because they want to buy gold with some leverage, right? You get leverage as a gold miner. As the price of gold continues to rise and your costs say, you know, even if they're variable, you increase your margins the higher the price of gold goes. If gold were to go parabolic, you would get a function of leverage on your gold miner investment versus just owning gold.
Right.
So to me, it seemed like the only way to go. It seemed like an obvious thing to do, which is why in May I tweeted out Berkshire is going to buy gold or gold miners at some point.
Really?
Bank on it. That was my exact tweet on like May 5th of this year, if you want to go back. Because I started to realize that the problem is getting too big. It's getting too big to ignore. It's getting not just from a standpoint of fodder, but also as a PM, as somebody that manages money, you can't ignore it because there's going to be profound effects on your investments and you want to be in the right place. You know, so Buffett actually sold positions in some of his US banks and went out and bought Barrick Gold. Right. So that's very telling. This is a guy that always said, don't bet against America, right? What he should have been saying for the last 30 years is don't bet against the Fed. Because the Fed has been the rising tide that has lifted his investments over the last 30 years. Am I impressed with Warren Buffett as an investor? Yes, I am. I'm even more impressed with him between 1950 and 1980, or 1950 and 1990, where he was making great fundamental value-based investment decisions to generate, you know, companies that generate cash consistently and reward their shareholders with dividends. I'm even more impressed by that. I'm still semi-impressed between 1990 and 2020. But the fact of the matter is, you could be the world's dumbest motherfucker and still have made money between 1990 and 2020 because the Fed has backstopped the markets and has backstopped everything. So Warren Buffett versus a basket of stocks that you could pick by literally laying them out on a desk and writing them down on paper and, you know, putting carrots on top of all of them and then letting a herd of wild goats come in and let them just chew whatever piece of paper they want first, those stocks may have performed as well, just as well as the Berkshire portfolio. I don't know. But the Fed has certainly been the rising tide that has lifted all of his investments. So look, I have thought for a long time that that's got to end at some point. When in 2018, when I did a presentation called Short the Whole Fucking Thing, the premise of the presentation was that Buffett's investing style wasn't going to last forever because it's predicated on this flawed monetary policy. And now we're starting to see the consequences of that. I couldn't have predicted that they were going to do $3-5 trillion of stimulus and QE in a 3-month period. That's perverse. That is absolutely a pornographic amount of money. So I think that has even jarred the heads of some of the biggest Keynesian thinkers in the world, Buffett included, who realize, hey, maybe it's time to think about gold, which is, I think it's very profound given that he has done nothing but talk shit about gold for 40 years, for 50 years. I think it is a huge sea change. I think it is going to enable many other PMs and investment managers and even the wealth managers that go out and buy ETFs for their clients and then sit around doing nothing all day in their Brooks Brothers suits. It's even going to enable them to go out and buy gold because they're going to say, hey, Buffett did it. So even if they get it wrong, they're going to be like, hey, Buffett got it wrong and so did I. I don't want to claim that last idea is my own. Peter Schiff said that on his podcast, but I think it's dead on balls. I think it makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I think we're going off the cliff and I think Buffett knows it.
Yeah. And you wonder if he would have bought more if he wouldn't have moved the market. Because I'm assuming buying that much
there's 45 days between when that position was put on and when it was disclosed. So he may have bought more already.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
We may not know it. That's only up to, I think, the end of Q2, George. That doesn't include all of July and these 17 days of August.
Yeah, yeah. My point is when you're playing with that much money, you can move the market. And I would assume that there's, I don't know what the float of Barrick is, but it's probably not like a GM or an Apple, something like that. So yeah. $500 million, that's a big deal. And he couldn't
it's up today,
allocate Barrick. $5 billion. He probably couldn't have, you know, he'd have to do it over a long period of time. So maybe he's doing
so. Barrick's up 11% today. Barrick has a $53 billion market cap. I think it is the largest gold miner or second largest gold miner. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that. So, you know, he bought, what did he buy? 1% of the company?
Yeah. And to your point, it's interesting that he bought that instead of a gold ETF. So he obviously wants some leverage. And if he does,
well, he may have already bought a gold ETF and we may not know it. If he did it over the last 45 days, we may not know it. But yeah, Barrick pays a dividend. They pay a nominal dividend, I think 1%. So it even keeps with his previous investing thesis of it should be a cash flow generative company that pays out a dividend to shareholders. So he kind of gets to check both boxes there. Fucking cheater.
All right. So what are your thoughts on this? Let me try to explain it to you. I did a video on this the other day, and I've been trying to think it through with a lot of different people that I talk to, and I'd love to get your opinion. So I know everyone is focused on the Fed's balance sheet, And, you know, it's all we talk about. The Fed's balance sheet went from $4 trillion, let's say, to $7 trillion. Is it going to $10 trillion? And we get hyper fixated on it because it means they're buying treasuries, they're buying assets, which they have to print up these bank reserves in order to do. But what I find interesting is no one ever focuses on the P&L. And, and you know, if the Fed is owned by private institutions or individuals, I mean, obviously there's a gray area there. And people would say, well, they only have a 6% dividend and all the profits go to the treasury. Not really. If you really pull back the layers of the onion, you find that there may be some accounts there that they even admit to where the funds don't go to the treasury and they don't tell you how much of the profit is actually going in to those accounts and then where it's going from there. So it's definitely, to say the least, there's a question mark there, but let's just assume.
Well, that's a great business model. If you want to be the world's professional worst fucking counterparty, which is exactly what the Fed is doing. They are the world's worst counterparty. They're buying. Go ahead.
But if you and I own the Fed, isn't that the model? I mean, think about this. You print your own money to buy financial assets, and then you can buy whatever you want. If you take a haircut, it's subsidized by the taxpayer. And if you don't, all the profit goes into your back pocket. So when you look at them buying companies like Apple, as far as their debt, or Microsoft, and you're sitting there scratching your head going, what? Why are they bailing out a company that's got the equivalent of $100 billion in cash on their balance sheet? And then you ask yourself, well, if you owned the Fed and you could print up your own money to buy whatever asset you wanted to, like, wouldn't you buy that if it was all about the P&L and not just about the balance sheet? So what do you think about that?
Wouldn't you buy what?
Well, wouldn't you buy assets that you know are gonna throw off cash? And you're going to buy the best assets. If it's a business and you own the Federal Reserve and you're going to pocket all the profits, you want it to generate as much profit as possible.
They don't care. They just buy whatever's in need to be bought.
But why does Apple need to be bought? Why does Microsoft?
They don't.
But so that's my point. Maybe they're buying it just because they're more focused on the P&L.
They don't. And then somebody asked Kashkari about this on Friday on CNBC. And they were like, Neil, what are you doing going in buying the bonds of Apple and Berkshire Hathaway and, you know, these companies that have $60 billion in cash, $40 billion in cash? And he said, well, we're not buying those bonds. We bought an ETF because we want to spread the money around equally. It's like, dumbass, what about all the private companies out there? What about the companies whose bonds are not included in that ETF, right? So first off, that explanation is so stupid that anybody with 1/1000th of a brain understands how moronic it is. You know, the Fed doesn't belong buying junk bonds, corporate junk bonds of any company. I don't care if it's Apple. I don't care if it's the world's most fiscally sound company that is going to return X amount over X amount of years. And we don't see the Fed's P&L anyways. We don't really get any type of transparency when it comes to that. So we can't tell whether or not the crap they're buying is going to pay off for them or whether or not it's not going to pay off for them.
Do you think that could be a motivating factor to what they're buying?
You think they're actively trying to invest, is what you're saying, to make money?
And make a profit. If I owned the Fed,
maybe.
I would.
maybe. I don't know. I don't really know. That's a good question. I mean, they've also bought a lot of crap too. I mean, they've bailed out a lot of garbage private equity firms. You know, these private equity firms shuffle the same six assets to one another every 5 years. It's like a game of hot potato. And every time it changes hands, they mark it up a certain amount because it's all level 3 accounting, right? So it's all basically how level 3 accounting works. If you don't know, is somebody walks into a room and goes, "Hey, Bill, what's fucking XYZ Corporation worth?" And the guy scratches his ass and scratches his head. And he goes, "Well, I don't know. What was the word last year? $2 billion. We marked it at last year. All right. Well, it's been 5 years. Mark it at $3 billion. And that's basically it. That's how level 3 accounting works. It's like a fair estimate of what the company's worth. So okay. You got the five or six biggest private equity firms in the world who have portfolios full of dog shit and have been trading them back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to each other, every time marking up the underlying assets with this hefty premium. And then when they're about to go tits up, the Fed comes in and rescues them too. So right. I don't think the Fed is savvy enough to be good investors. I think they're just buying whatever willy-nilly. I really do. I don't think they have any kind of calculation. I think they're just, you know, I mean, one of the Fed governors went on television and said, we have infinite money. Infinite money. Does that strike you as an intelligent thing to say, that somebody that's being careful and calculated in the way that they do business would say that? Or does that come off like a 12-year-old who just stole mom's credit card and is running through the toy store? You know, I've got infinite money. I mean, the correct answer to how much money you can print is, well, you know, even though everybody knows they can create as much money as they want, the right answer for somebody that had a brain would be like, well, you know, the Fed has sufficient liquidity. If necessary, we can provide so-and-so, but we want to be measured and we want to make sure that we're not doing anything that could return any unintended consequences.
Yeah,
that's
right.
A nice way to say we have infinity money, but you don't go on television and just say we have infinity money. Like, so no, I don't think they're smart enough to be investing for the dividend and for the cash flow stream.
Okay, we'll shelf that for a moment. Okay, so another thing, whenever someone asks me, and I don't know if I've said this on any of my videos, but just privately, how I see government, I like to use the analogy of Hannibal Lecter. Did you watch those movies, those Silence of the Lambs movies?
Yeah, I did back in the day.
Remember Hannibal Lecter? He was that guy that he was the most dangerous human being like ever on Earth. And they had to put like that mask on him.
Yeah.
Walk him to the thing like that because he was so dangerous and he could get into your head and make you do crazy things. But this serial killer they were trying to find, they knew that he was the key, the only person that could help them find and stop the serial killer.
Buffalo Bill, right?
Buffalo Bill, that's right.
Yeah.
Anthony Hopkins and his character in Silence of the Lambs. So my point is, I see government as that's their purpose. Like in an ideal world, they would be Hannibal Lecter, to where that it's just an absolute last case, your worst case scenario. Right. We're going to war. Oh my gosh, we have to do something. We've exhausted all of our resources. Do we use Hannibal Lecter?
We've went to Congress. Congress has okayed a declaration of war.
But it's just the worst case. It's just the nuclear option is pulling out Hannibal Lecter, because you know there is so much downside
to
playing that game, that if you do it wrong, you're done. You're done. He's going to get in your head. And so
government's doing the polar opposite of that. The polar opposite.
Isn't that like government to, as citizens, as a society, shouldn't we see government as Hannibal Lecter, in the sense that
yes,
we want to avoid using them at all costs because of this limitless downside?
Of course. I think that's what many of your listeners and my listeners think already, you know?
Well,
why? Well, governments are terrible. They're a terrible allocator of capital. All right. There's no expertise, right? The government's a terrible allocator of capital. They're wasteful in the way that they spend. They're overreaching in the regulations and in the, things that they suggest for private citizens. And I mean, really, many libertarians just want the government to be there for purposes of national security and helping enforce laws, things like that. But I
just don't think the average person sees the downside. So it's like, oh, well, I don't want my neighbor to cut their grass. Oh, let's go to Hannibal Lecter. Inequality. Oh, let's go to
shoot
Hannibal
him,
Lecter.
Right.
Hannibal Lecter will handle it. You see, my point there is no. Keep Hannibal Lecter jailed up. Let's try to
talk
solve
to your neighbor
on our own.
Right.
And then we're going to be much better moving forward.
If you don't want your neighbor to cut the grass a certain way, talk to your neighbor. And if that doesn't work, then you go to your local municipal court, your municipal state, your municipal police department, and then you try to settle it there. Yeah. You don't pull out a gun and start shooting because you're, you know, the neighbor's grass is half an inch too high. It's a terrible idea. I mean, I think if there's a bipartisan idea that most people can get behind, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian, or you're an independent, or you're a woman or a man, black, white, Asian, whether you're gay, straight, trans, or whatever, I think if there's a collective idea we can all get behind, it's that politicians, for the most part, are fucking useless. They are only worried about getting themselves reelected and staying in power. And that is really what they base a lot of their decisions off of. Nobody has any backbone. Nobody has any spine. Nobody stands for anything. It's all about getting reelected, and it's all about making quick, decisive decisions for temporary solutions to appease the people that are going to be directly responsible for keeping them in office by any means necessary, regardless of what the consequences could be on the nation, on their municipality, on their state, whatever, going forward. Yeah. So that is a bipartisan idea I think we can all get behind. We just don't need government. I always go back to this example of like years ago. I remember I pulled money out of a savings account several times and they sent me a notice in the mail. You can only make so-and-so withdrawals a month. Maybe it was four. I don't remember. You can only make four withdrawals a month. I called the bank. I said, what the fuck is this? I got plenty of money. I had to take it out. I was making like major purchases. Maybe I was renovating my home or something. I don't remember. But I was pulling money out.
Yeah.
They said, federal law mandates you can only take so-and-so out of your account four times a month. They want to encourage saving. I'm like, that doesn't encourage anything. It just pisses me off. Right. Yeah, it was something like that.
Encourage saving?
It's just, you know, let us go. Let us go, okay? Personal responsibility. We're all doing okay, George. You and me, we wake up in the mornings and we go to bed at night without the assistance of the government. I don't need a government to tell me to get up and make a cup of coffee and come up here to the office and start earning money for myself. Capitalism does that. Money does that. You know, I know that that's the right thing to do. You know how many times a year I call the police? Maybe one or two. If there's a problem or there's an issue or I feel like there's a tree down in a road where it could impede somebody's access to that area, whatever, I use my government sparingly. I don't mind paying for the water department. I don't mind paying, even school taxes are okay here. I prefer not to since I don't have any kids, but that's okay. You know, I pay a sewer rental here. That's fine. The government manages that. That's all private. That's all my little tiny municipality that I live in. You know, I don't need the federal government reaching into areas of my life, you know, and trying to, oh, the Department of Energy, the Department of Education, the Department of fucking Twizzlers, the Department of Breakfast Cereal, the Department of Alcohol and Firearms. It's like, I don't need that. And your listeners and my listeners, I would guarantee probably 90% of us similarly situated think the same exact thing.
Yeah, I'm probably preaching to the choir. I love that they want you to, to save more. They're encouraging you to save while the Fed's taking interest rates to zero.
Well, one is posturing, one's virtue signaling and positioning and saying, hey, we want everybody to be sound when it comes to finances. And the other is action, right? So going back to our virtue signaling discussion from before, let your game do the talking. Don't talk about it, be about it. The government might talk about saving. The government might talk about reducing inequality. But what are their actions? The Fed's actions are widening the inequality gap. You know, the government's actions are widening
savings. They don't want you to save. They think it's the opposite of what you should.
Yeah, but they don't come out and say that. They don't come out and say that. They just send that signal to the market by keeping interest rates at zero.
Yeah. All right. So I know we're on a hard deadline here, Chris, and I appreciate your time.
You got plenty of time.
One thing. One of the main things that I've been hearing.
I'm just getting started, George.
No, we're just getting warmed up, buddy. But one of the main things I hear in the comments of my videos and on my Twitter feed is people obviously concerned about what we've been talking about, the social unrest. If they live in a community, you know, when is this going to happen to where I live? They're concerned with the lockdowns and their loss of personal freedom, that they have to not only wear a mask, but there's curfews. When I was in Fort Lauderdale, as an example, you couldn't go out past 10 o'clock at night. I mean, these are Orwellian things that we couldn't have even imagined that would come into play in the next decade, let alone the next year, going back to 2019. And then, you know, what a struggle it is right now for Americans to travel with an American passport. I mean, who would have thought that going back? I mean, we discussed this briefly. So I'd be curious, as someone who's a libertarian and really values personal freedom and liberty like I do, what are you doing in your own life as kind of this, I don't want to say a bug out strategy, but a strategy like a plan B. So if it does hit the fan or you're looking around you saying, listen, I want no part of this, of what's going on right now. Well, what's your game plan there?
Well, I don't really have a like super detailed game plan, but for trying to own gold and silver, which I think will be the keys to unlocking or maintaining your current level of prosperity that you have now at the very least. So I think at some point, you know, California is a great example, right? People are starting to leave California in favor for Texas and Florida because the taxes are too high.
Yeah, Californians are
in Puerto Rico, right? Californians are starting to figure out that, well, the politicians aren't, but the citizens are starting to figure out that too much taxation and too much government really starts to mess with people's lives, messes with their livelihood. It messes with their families, and people don't take kindly to that. And so Gavin Newsom, that's trying to increase the state's tax the way that he's doing it now, he's driving people out of the state. And I'm not sure that the same thing isn't going to happen with the United States at some point. If that happens, it will be because we have destroyed the dollar. That will be, you know, we're not going to lose a military war, I don't think. I think it's going to be destruction from within. We have a vein of Marxists in this country that I think are not helping. And I think we have a central bank that is not helping. And so to me, the way that I try to protect myself to the extent that I'll be alive when this stuff happens, if it happens. And by the way, if it doesn't happen, that's great too. Then, you know, I'm just a nutbag that owns a lot of guns and gold, and that's fine. I sleep very well at night. But to me, that's how I'm trying to protect myself, right? I'm armed. I'm legally armed. So I'm permitted to carry a weapon. I stay armed most times, and I own precious metals. And I've tried to diversify myself, not just between dollar denominated instruments and, you know, stocks and bonds, whatever, but also into things like real estate and commodities, and try to get exposure to tons of different asset classes. But mostly my biggest holding is gold and silver. I mean, those are my two insurance plans, and I'm gonna take their multiple thousand year track record as an economic instrument, and combined with the fact that the Fed is tacitly okaying them by owning gold and silver, or just gold as in reserve. And I'm also looking at things like the International Bank of Settlements, who just declared gold to be a tier one asset, according to my friend Andy Schechtman, who I just had on my podcast. I find that very telling. I find like that might be something that's setting us up for a different kind of reset at some point. Who knows? But that's pretty much it. And then I will make my decisions as necessary on a go-forward basis. I don't have a trap door with a tunnel that leads to Puerto Rico or something like that yet. But we'll see. But I do think, you know, for me, in wanting to be prepared, I think about my livelihood the same way I think about my portfolio, which is I want to be prepared for everything, not just not just something that is a slight problem. Like I think most people out there are prepared. You know, we've got 2 days of food, George, and we've got flood insurance on our house. It's like, okay, like that'll save you for a couple of things. Well, I want to be prepared for everything between what we're doing right now, which is having a nice cozy chat on a weekday, and complete fucking Armageddon. I want to cover every scenario between this and that to the best of my ability. And I think owning precious metals is one way to kind of gain exposure to that across the board.
Have you thought about moving? I don't know if you live in an urban area. I think you're close to Philly there. Have you thought about moving out to a more rural area or getting an RV or anything like that?
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, recently I did move to a more rural area. Okay. So I'm still very close to the city. I'm about as far out of the city as you can get and just start to touch on a rural area for several reasons. One of which was the city tax, which really has gotten out of control. You know, property values, where I think I'm going to get the most bang for my buck there, things like that. So, so that's something that I've already done. Plus, where I was working before for a company called Geo Investing, they were outside of the city as well. So commuting from Germantown, which is where I was living prior, which is a neighborhood in Philly, Germantown to out here and back and forth, you know, it was an hour and 15 minutes each way. So I didn't want to do that anymore. And now I've just kind of stayed out here, but I do spend a fair amount of time in the city still. And I'm even considering maybe making a second purchase in a portion of the city that I like, that I think will be developed soon, but that hasn't happened yet. So,
yeah. You know, I've got guys, real good buddies of mine who are in Phoenix, and they just didn't like what was going on with the riots. And I don't know if it's still bad in Phoenix. I don't think it is, but they just got an RV and just went straight up to like Sholo, Arizona, up in the mountains, and are just there in their RV with internet, just working from RV campsite until they feel as though it's an appropriate time to go back, and when the dust settles and with COVID and everything. And I always like to get you know, people's opinion on that, but that's definitely something that I'd be doing if I was in the state.
I don't know why everybody doesn't do that. And I also don't know, again, this isn't a political statement, but I don't know what is blinding people to the fact that these liberal policies are going to drive people out of liberal cities. Yeah. I mean, it's just, at the end of the day, it boils down to, do you want law and order where you live? Do you want to raise a family? Or even me, I don't even have a family, but I just want to be uninterrupted and undisturbed. And I want things to go the way that they're supposed to. I want people to drive on the right side of the road. I want to avoid crime. You know,
it's a civil society, for heaven's sakes.
Right. I just want a civil society. And when you look at a place like Chicago, where the mayor is refusing help from the federal government because, I don't know, the optics, I'm not really sure what the problem is. She doesn't want to make it look as though, you know, she's agreeing with Trump, or maybe she's just absolutely clueless and thinks everything's fine. But you see the city just disintegrating, and you have to know people are on their way out, and the mayor's up there like, and the same thing happened in Seattle, and it's happening in a lot, you know, it's happening in Philadelphia to some degree as well. I mean, they're lighting police cars on fire at Broad and Arch in Philadelphia. I mean, that's 10 blocks from City Hall. That's not that far away. They, you know, they're tearing down statues. They're defacing City Hall. It's abhorrent. And the mayor of Philadelphia won't accept the National Guard and say, oh, we got it. We got it. It's like, you don't got it. You don't have it. So that's the kind of stuff that's going to drive people out of cities, especially when you combine it with, you know, these policies. In Philadelphia, we need a soda tax. Now there's a soda tax in Philadelphia. There's a straw tax. It's like, my friends that are restaurant owners, they just can't do it anymore. You know, you're telling people, leave the city. You're telling people to get out of the city. I mean, it's just one of the best bars in Philadelphia. I got to tell you, one of the best bars in Philadelphia is between Broad and 13th Street, and it's on Locust. It's called Locust Rendezvous. It's a little hole in the wall on Locust Street. It is my favorite bar in the city, hands down. Mm. I love it. I love the people that work there. There is a woman that has worked there for a while during the day. She's like semi-famous in Philadelphia. Her name's Michelle. She's like one of my favorite bartenders of all time. She's just a wonderful individual, wonderful person. She's warm. She's inviting. I'm Facebook friends with her. I see her feed on her Facebook, and I see her actively talking about the consequences of these, you know, increased taxations for the business.
And
it is hurting
the virus laws too. I mean,
it's hurting my favorite bar in the city. Okay. Take whatever you want. Take my car, take my gold, but don't fuck with my favorite bar in the city and my favorite bartender, Michelle, please. I mean, the government doesn't understand that you're driving people out of the city. You got to screw. The other thing too is I was at Suburban Station on a Sunday, I don't know, months ago. And Suburban Station, I was on a date, actually, believe it or not. That was my one date.
Is that a bar? What is Suburban Station?
It's the train station right under City Hall. It's okay. Where if there's three stations in Philadelphia, there's Market East, which is at 9th and Market on the east side of the city. There's Suburban Station under City Hall. And then there's 30th Street Station, which is on the west side of the city. Okay. So I was, and this is actually probably years ago, not 6 months ago, now that I'm thinking about it. But I was walking back through the station on a Sunday night with this woman that I was out with, and the station looked like a demilitarized zone. There was human fecal matter on the floor. There were people all over the place. There was garbage. There was food. It was disgusting. It was absolutely filthy. So I took photographs of everything and I sent it to the mayor's office, the same mayor that's in office right now. And they sent me back a response and they were like, well, you know, we'll try to get to it, whatever. Then I went back a couple weeks later. It was the same situation. There was, honestly, New York's Penn Station looks better at 3 a.m. on a Sunday than Philadelphia's Suburban Station. It was disgusting. I lived in Philly for over a decade. I know what that station looks like most times when it's clean. This was unlike anything I had ever seen. So I go up to a SEPTA cop that's sitting at his desk there where there's like a little information booth where the train station is. And I said, hey man, what's going on? Hey, how are you? I said, what the hell is going on here? I said, this place looks like a fucking war zone. And the guy's like, you know what? We can't do anything. The mayor won't let us do anything. We can't touch these people. We can't tell them to leave. We can't escort them out. We can't, you know, we can't do anything. He said, we're completely powerless because the mayor is afraid that somebody with a cell phone camera is going to come through here and take a photograph of what's going on. And all of a sudden we're going to be in trouble for accosting an innocent homeless guy or somebody that's down here screaming and shouting. I said, this is absolutely insane. I don't even like, you know, SEPTA cops too much, George, but I had to agree with him. I mean, I have a bad experience with SEPTA cops. It dates back to my days as a skateboarder, but that's a different story, you know. But these were honest guys that really wanted to do their job and they really wanted to clean the place up and they were being respectful and they had candor with me in their discussion with me, and they couldn't do it. They said, the mayor has tied our hands, and we're seeing the same thing in New York City right now. Crime is skyrocketing. I saw an article
San Francisco
the other day that bulletproof vest sales in New York are up like 80%. I just saw the other day. Okay. It's like the city's turning into fucking Blade Runner. So at some point people are going to realize that the politicians are the problem. Sorry to talk.
If I'm in your position though, Chris, I'm like, if I would have seen that, I'm like, I'm gone. I like, life's too short. I'm pulling the ripcord. I'm out. I would have been on a plane the next day. I mean, so at what point is enough enough for you personally?
Well, I mean, that certainly contributed to my decisions to, you know, stay out of the city and certainly to stay the hell out of Suburban Station on a Sunday night.
I would have left the state. I mean, if not the whole country, I've been like, I'm out. No more.
It's just totally inexcusable. And actually, interestingly enough, the woman that I was with that night on the date was from Montreal. And she was telling me that, and I've spent a lot of time in Montreal, so I know what it's like up there. It looks nothing like that. You know, she's like, what is going on in your city that this is what this place looks like? She was genuinely befuddled. I mean, yes, you pay a lot higher taxes in Quebec, so that's, you know, we have to account for that definitely. But she just couldn't, it was unconscionable to her that a problem like that, it wasn't being dealt with. They were just there. And that's how it is every Sunday night. And there's just going to be shit on the floor. Enjoy your train ride home.
Yeah, it's the exact same thing last time I was in Portland, Oregon. I mean, the homeless population there has completely taken over. the entire city, and they won't do anything about it. I went to Starbucks a couple times. I was there for a buddy's birthday party, so I was there for maybe 3 or 4 days. I'd go into Starbucks just right downtown, you know, in what was a very, very nice part of Portland, Oregon. And I personally had to kick out two homeless guys from two different Starbucks where I was, because they were screaming, they were spitting, they were using profanity, and they were really frightening some of the patrons of the Starbucks. In one particular case, some elderly women that were there trying to enjoy a coffee. And when I first got there, I was like, I'm looking at the employees like, hello, are you going to kick this guy out or what? Right. And they said the exact same thing. No, we can't do anything. I'm like, well, call the cops. And they're like, the police won't do anything, because for the same reasons you said. And then the homeless people were using the restrooms to shoot up drugs. They'd be in there for a half hour shooting up drugs. And so you couldn't use the restroom. And this is what it's come to. I mean, this is...
And I don't want to take away from the fact, I don't want to take away from the fact that it, you know, these are serious mental health issues and personal health issues that these people have, right? I don't want to be like, oh, we should just eliminate homeless people from the face of the earth, because I don't feel like that shit. That's not how I feel. But we have to have a civil society, and we have to have law and order, you know?
The cost benefit analysis there that you have to do as well.
Sure. Sure, absolutely. You know, a cost-benefit analysis of how that problem should be dealt with effectively. You know, hey, there's a lot of people that are addicted to drugs that do a lot of crazy shit, and they go to jail, and they're forced to sober up in jail, and they come out of jail and say, I never want to go back there again, and so they get clean. I mean, I know people that have stories like that, right? So the idea that, oh, we can't touch these people, whatever, we just got to let this guy stand in the middle of a Starbucks, disrupt a private business, okay, where you should be able to have whoever you want in and whoever you want out of it at any and all times. If it's a privately owned business and you got somebody in there, you don't want them, I don't care who they are and I don't care why you don't want them in there, you should really, as a private business, be allowed to have them out. Whether it's distasteful or not is a different discussion, but just by rule of law. And so in a case like this, like, yeah, we have to have a civil society. You know, you can't go into a Wendy's to get a hamburger and wind up getting assaulted by somebody.
They'd be scared to take the kids in there.
Right, right. Exactly. And it's terrible for the businesses and just, you know, I don't know, man. It's just, it's a bad scene in terms of the way that politicians think about it. And again, it goes back to having a backbone. Okay, it goes back to having a backbone. Politicians don't want to have a backbone because they want to get reelected, and especially those on the left, they don't want to look like they're insensitive. You know, you can be sensitive to the needs of people that have mental health issues, but also advocate for law and order. You could do the both of them. All you need is some confidence and some backbone. My listeners understand that. Your listeners understand that. Most people I talk to, no matter what side of the political aisle they're on, understand that. But it's these cowardly, dickless politicians, okay, that think that because they advocate for law and order in a situation where privately owned businesses are being burned to the ground and people are being assaulted, that somehow they're going to be looked at as insensitive. And we don't need people like that in government. Those people should be working at some kind of fuzzy feel good job somewhere, you know, where they get encouraged to give everybody hugs and pats on the back all day. They should not be elected officials. It's like running a business. You don't want a person like that as your CEO, do you? You wouldn't want somebody as George Gammon Incorporated CEO who's gonna make business decisions just based on their feelings. You have to put the P&L in there too. You have to look at how the business is doing. And the cities and the states, those are businesses too. And the country is a business too. So you have to look at that too. You have to look at the P&L. How do we keep revenue coming in? Well, we got to keep citizens here paying taxes. Well, how do we do that? We need to make them happy. How do we make them happy? We make it so that they can go to a fucking Starbucks and get a banana bread and a muffin without getting spit on by somebody that rolled in off the street. Yeah. That's the end of that rant. Sorry.
But you're right that it's just like a business in the sense that you can't, as a business owner, I was an entrepreneur for many years, you can't pander to a vocal minority.
Right.
Whether your employees or whomever, it just doesn't work. And that's exactly what they're doing. Chris, I know you got a hard deadline, buddy. So we'll go ahead and wrap things up. Thank you very much for your time. As always, a fantastic
conference. I love you.
We could go on and on forever. But
I'm getting warmed up just now. I'm going to have to do my own podcast tonight and just let this next 2 hours out of my system, because you just opened a whole can of worms.
Uh-oh. Now you're really going to go off some rants. So I'll have to listen to your podcast tonight for sure to hear these rants. But for my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do and your amazing QTR podcast, where can they go?
I don't like to promote my stuff. I'm a big believer in...
Well, I'll promote it. Look up QTR podcast.
Let me just tell you something. I got my tiny group of listeners on my podcast because people like what I have to say, not because I'm out there buying Facebook ads. So I never like to promote. I just say, the wind will take my podcast wherever they want. Lucky for me, I'm not in it to be like, oh, Mr. Number One Finance Podcast. I don't give a shit about any of that, right? So if you find it, that's great. I want you to come to it naturally. It's like wooing a woman, I always say, right? You want the spark to kind of occur naturally. You don't want to you don't grab a woman by the neck and go, let's go out to fucking dinner, So yeah, just find it naturally if you'd like. And if not, that's cool too. But I love you. I love everybody. I love your listeners. And I got to go.
All right. Take it easy, buddy.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.